Hey everybody, and welcome to the Daily Objective, brought to you by the Ayn Rand Center UK. I'm here, Mark Pellegrino, one of your semi-regular hosts, along with a very special guest, James Valiant, author, thinker, former prosecutor. We think he can bring his insights to the topic today, which is China a real threat? And we certainly hear in the news, if you read any conservative news, for sure, you hear that China is the next big threat, and they seem to be, the conservatives, that is, angling us towards another Cold War, either series of confrontations or standoffs, or at least exciting that kind of Cold War fear in the population. We can sort out if that is justified. Certainly, we found out after many years that the fear of the Soviet Union was rather unjustified. It was a teddy bear, not a Soviet bear. It had about 19% of our GDP and couldn't fight us adequately if it really tried. And is the same illusion present with the Chinese? Do we really have to worry about them as a threat in the future? James, I think, could give us some great insight. James, great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always great to be here, Mark.
So what do you think of this? What do you think of this big question? Is China a problem?
Well, China's a problem, that's for sure. But it's because we're empowering China. To the extent that China is an economic or now growing military threat, it's because, as usual, dictator. It's not just Russia that wasn't 10 feet tall. They were always, a paper tiger, a paper bear, I guess would be the better analogy. As Ayn Rand pointed out, they invaded Little Finland twice during World War II and were repelled by the Finns. And you look at what's going on in Ukraine today. Ayn Rand had a great line about Russia. If it ever came to war between America and Russia, she said it wouldn't be a major issue because half, this is, I think, her exact quote, half the miserable Russians would defect. And her prediction, I think, is coming true pretty much in Ukraine. Russia was never 10 feet tall. She predicted we could destroy the Soviet Empire without the loss of a single American life. And that's how it came to pass, by just showing a little moral backbone. Again, that's how it came to pass. And the fact that the communism was an economic basket case. Now, things are a little different with China. They're not quite the economic basket case that Russia is. And they've done so, again, by the same means that Russia did it, in effect, supporting itself by sucking technology and trade from the West. It is their intellectual theft. They've been stealing intellectual property left and right from businesses who are doing business in China and from businesses who are not doing business in China. And it was this opening up. See, doing a little history, during the Cold War against the Soviet Empire, Richard Nixon had the bright idea of opening up relations with the other great communist power, China, to sort of split those two apart, to split the communist world into, and by creating this division, weaken Russia, in effect. There are those who say, boy, that really worked. I'm not sure it did have the effect of bringing down the Soviet Union in any way, shape, or form, but it did have us recognizing and doing friendly relations and cultural exchanges and opening up trade with China, much to China's great advantage. What's causing China's wealth is that Apple and Nike and vast international corporations are now doing vast business with them, much to their benefit. So were America to stop sanctioning Russia morally, I think the problem would largely end, because I think most businesses would not voluntarily do business in a place that America, for example, didn't have diplomatic relationship with at all. I, along with Ayn Rand, do not believe that any dictatorship should be recognized as legitimate government by the United States ever. She believed, for example, that we shouldn't even be allies with Russia during World War II. So if she thought it was morally intolerable to ally ourselves with Russia when you're fighting the Nazis during a world war, imagine what she would think about having cultural exchange programs and economic trade where China is completely diddling us by stealing our property and so forth. How much lower an opinion she would have of that, with much less of an excuse for dealing with these moral monsters. I mean, you look at what they're doing with the Uyghurs. You look at what they did with Hong Kong. You look at how they still control speech in China. They are, and that the militant activities. I mean, we recently had the Japanese government, in effect, say America and China are already at war the other day. Now, Biden is reassuring us, of course, that, oh, no, there's no reason for a new Cold War. You know, again, I would make a comparison with Russia. I do not think that at this point America should be planning for a war. America should be trying to avoid World War III with any major military, especially nuclear power, in my mind. That's really important in my mind to try and avoid nuclear war. But on the other hand, we're the ones enabling and supporting whatever threat that China actually is representing. Their technology and their economic base being superior to Russia's is our doing, a direct result of our moral sanctioning of China. That's the cause of the problem, not that, you know, Chinese authoritarianism is 10 foot tall. They've had some more market reforms, you know, Yaron Brook got his book published in China. I mean, that's, I guess, a good sign. But China still very much censors and controls the information. They are not, in my mind, a morally legitimate government. But as Ayn Rand also said, that doesn't mean that America should go to war with them. That depends on the context and America's interests. But the first thing we should stop doing is feeding a dictatorship. It is dictatorship that is the cause of war. And the weaker we are, truly, the weaker we are, the more we embolden China to make its move on Taiwan, which in my mind would be a moral outrage.
So, you know, this seems to fly in the face of what the culture accepts to be true. It's not dictatorships that start wars, it's capitalist countries that start wars. And in this case, many would point to the fact that Nike and Microsoft and or Apple are sending a business over there as an example of, look, profit rules. They don't care about how these people treat their workers. All they care about is the bottom line. And so all that capital goes over there to take advantage of all the human beings and sometimes slave labor. What would you say to something like that?
Well, it's just exactly the opposite of the truth. If China would be reluctant to go to war with Taiwan, with us over Taiwan, it would be because we're economically interdependent and they realize their own economic interdependence. Imagine they invade Taiwan. Imagine that America doesn't even have a military response. America would surely have vast sanctions which might disrupt trade. Their economy is far more dependent on trade with us than ours is on theirs. So Ludwig von Mises made a great point in his book, Liberalism, published 100 years ago. Trade is one of the great causes of peace. If you think about it today, just within a couple of generations, the idea of America going to war with Japan or Germany is unthinkable because of the economic interdependence of Japan on the American economy and the America on Japan and Germany. Trade actually makes war. The more trade you have, the more inconceivable the war will take place. China does not always act on its economic interests purely, but surely it is even aware that it would face economic sanctions of huge kind. So if there's anything keeping us from war with China, I would say it's the extensive trade that we have with them. On the other hand,
do you think that was on the mind of somebody even as pragmatic as Nixon? That enmesh a country in trade and we become interdependent entities and there's no possible way that they would want to fight.
More than that, we believed there were a lot of people who sincerely believed that if we opened up trade with China, that means that we would get a foot in the door with our ideas, that if we could get the internet there, there'd be no way they could stop free speech, and that somehow free trade would undermine the system, and they would move to a system of greater civil liberties. I'm afraid history has proved that to be false. Whatever liberalization in the market side China has done, it doesn't seem to have changed the government in Beijing's attitude about censorship and their authoritarian approach to things. Their treatment of the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, Hong Kong, are just classic. So they're jailing people for their dissident opinions in Hong Kong now, and they're just disappearing people. So no, we should have no diplomatic relations with China. And I think that would do far more harm to China and would probably get China, to, if they were smart, to actually cause reform. That would, I think, encourage them to cause internal reforms more than anything else. But in the meantime, we're only helping the Beijing government oppress their own people.
Agreed. Now that we seem to be, or at least our leaders seem to be infected with this this fallacy that the hearts of people everywhere are open to liberty and all they need is exposure to that and they will come running to the folds of liberty. Bush seemed to be excited by that same notion, the neoconservative notion that all we have to do is push democracy, quote unquote, liberty, and those institutions into the world and people will see that they're superior to their own traditional values and they'll adopt them. Not the case. And now we have Xi in his, what, third term as the president, unprecedented third term.
He'll be dictator for life, yeah.
Which is clearly what he's pushing for. And the more they push for that, the harder the CCP line becomes. And I think the further away from whatever free market innovations they incorporated to give them some prosperity, the further away from that they're going to step. And I think the more dangerous they become to their immediate neighbors, but the less of a threat they become overall to us. What do you say to that?
You nailed it. Just exactly correct, Mark. Once more, your insight is very, very well put. I can only double down on those comments. Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen in Taiwan? Certainly they've been bringing their military exercises closer and closer and closer. They're intimidating them. I'm assuming the reason they want it is because it's the semiconductor capital of the world and they would like to have those resources in their possession. But certainly with governments like this, with people like Putin, with people like Xi, they have an investment in tradition and they have an investment in the stature of their country in the world. And they have this investment in one China, which we stupidly endorsed. Now, how do we walk that back now that we've conceded that Taiwan is a part of China?
Well, what we've done is played a weird conceptual game, a dance, word game dance with them. One China. Well, what does that mean? We've left that sort of vague. The idea that nationalist China would be pushed out in favor of communist China into the Security Council was one of the great crimes of international history in the last 100 years. But the Congress has passed a law that said we should come to the defense of China should that ever happen. The president and our executive branch still maintains this policy that no, we're in favor of one China. So we're not disagreeing with mainland China on this, but we hope that this can all be resolved peacefully. So our position is sort of legally ambiguous and morally ambiguous based on the mixed signals we've given to poor Taiwan. Now, you ask what I think the prospects are. I think China was looking at Ukraine and not so much Russia's own success there, but the international response to it. And I think the international response to it has been strong enough to probably discourage them from actually doing it. As you point out, what they need is the economic infrastructure of Taiwan and to basically, and they would have to largely destroy the relatively small island of Taiwan in order to take it over. They don't want that to happen. They would, like Hong Kong, if they could just come in and take over the physical infrastructure, that would be easier. And I don't think they think they can do that with Taiwan. So I think they're pounding their chest and rattling their sabers. But I'm hoping that, and the thing is, the Chinese government, I think, is a little more cautious than Putin on this matter. And so I'm hoping that that's the way it ends and that they see that there would be a huge economic response that would hurt them, even worse than, say, COVID, because no one wanted to investigate that. There'd actually be a firm Western response on something like that. And to that extent, I think they are less likely to do it than to do it. But it's a guess. I can't predict. Maybe this is the start of something awful. You know, they're sending their ships into Australian waters. They're sending their ships. They're, you know, shooting missiles, right over Taiwan. So they're doing major saber rattling. But that could just be negotiating position. That could just be, take us seriously.
Well, what do you think America's response should be to something like that? Because clearly it's a bully tactic intended to intimidate the Western world. I think the response should be harsh, not military in kind, but a beginning of decoupling and sending an unequivocal message to Xi. You continue to do this, we are going to decouple from you industrially. We are going to take away our money. Sorry, that's just the way it's going to be. I think that would, I think that might make a shift in him, because Xi is not stupid. You said, the Chinese are more cautious than Putin. Putin is just not smart. I know everybody tries to make him the smartest guy in the room. He's just not. He's a megalomaniacal, malignant narcissist who's got this nationalist ideal in his head, and that's what he's living out, despite what the facts of reality are telling him. Xi, I think, is certainly more practical and understands that he's riding the back of a tiger, and that tiger can only be pleased by a certain amount of free markets coming in, right? He has to understand, to a degree, as much of an ideologue as he is, that his status system, it parasitizes the relatively free parts of the market and needs them and cannot have those things taken out from under him without great cost to him. What do you say of a mass uncoupling? The second those ships enter the waters of Australia, the second those planes do flybys in Taiwan, okay, we're going to start pulling industry from you.
That's it. That's really what we've left ourselves with as a response, haven't we? We should decouple. We should start decoupling now, it seems to me, as a result. But absolutely, there would be a total economic boycott of your country. And we would insist that all of our allies do so. If you did such a thing, and we should make it perfectly clear. I think you're right. I think a distinction needs to be made. For example, when Putin says, I'm going to use nukes in Ukraine, we need to make it absolutely abundantly clear that he would be wiped out and destroyed should he even try such a thing. And that would be my position on that.
Now, do you do that with words? Do you do that with words, or do you do that actually by wiping out those front lines with a few of your own missiles and saying, this is a taste of what's coming in the future?
Well, the closer he gets, the more realistic that threat becomes. I would opt for the second as well. Yes, both are on the table as far as I'm concerned, but we should at least not have the pusillanimous, weak-kneed response. How did Biden begin the whole year? If it's just a little incursion, that just encourages it. We need to be very strong. We cannot tolerate anyone using nuclear weapons on a neighboring country. We need to make that clear, and we need to make it really clear that we would respond very strongly. With Taiwan, it's a little different. I think we could say, look, even your threats will cause us to totally economically decouple. And strike one, strike two, and it's going to be all over if you keep it up. That's what we're left to with them. And I agree with you. I think that might be sufficient pressure to change, or at least modify to some degree, China's aggressiveness.
So we have a super chat here from Mary Aline for $5. For Xi, political power takes precedence over economic prosperity, no matter what the consequences. Do you think that's true, no matter what the consequences, with somebody like Xi?
Well, I think that there's enough. China has changed over the last 20, 30, 40 years economically, and a much larger percentage of China's population, especially the influential population, are now more comfortable and economically better off than they've ever been before. I'm not so sure about the masses, the masses, especially in the east of China or in Tibet. On the other hand, there is now an economic and political class which has gotten used to things being a whole lot better than they used to be. And those people would be directly under threat if the trade was cut off with the West. And that that's the only thing in my mind that could put political pressure on Xi.
Political power is important to him for sure, but economic prosperity is dependent on his compromise of that political power. And I think the more people sink after having experienced economic prosperity, the worse it will become for him. It's not like North Korea, where people have and don't have a contrast. They have no, they have not only no information coming in, but they have no contrast to the poverty that they're in. The Chinese do now.
Exactly right. See, I think the great thing that could bring Putin's government down is an economic or is a military failure in Ukraine. I think the thing that might bring Xi down, the only thing that might bring Xi down, is an economic collapse of his country and cutting off of trade with the West. Now, of course, there are all kinds of corporate interests in America, from Nike to Apple, like I say, who would bitterly complain about the business opportunities they're getting with this vast market of a billion Chinese. But that's what we have to do.
But isn't China's GDP a sort of Potemkin village, so to speak? I mean, haven't they built entire cities that are occupied by no one? The bricks are hollow. I've heard of entire structures now crumbling in China because of they built these things largely to produce a very high seeming GDP for the rest of the world. I mean, one thing we know about totalitarian countries, they have to live in a lie, and they have to project images to the rest of the world that imply that they're extremely strong and powerful and self-sufficient when they are not. And that implies, you know, a certain kind of deception on the economic levels. And as far, I think I remember not so far in the past, an economic crash that was happening in China that was staved off by the government refusing to allow the market to fall the way it needed to fall. And that they are in a bit of economic trouble as we speak. So I don't think decoupling, even if just the start of the decoupling in the economic state that they're really in, could be a shattering blow.
Could be a shattering, shattering blow. But as you say, are we overstating the actual prosperity that they brought even to some of their population? Because so much of it is just empty show. And they are, you know, if a socialist economic project was efficient and worked out, I'd be very surprised at all. So yeah, much of it is just for show. It is a facade. It is a movie set, an analogy you might get. It is just a movie set, as communist regimes generally are in their economics. But to some extent, China has liberalized their economic in some ways, and certainly opened up to foreign trade, and certainly stolen technology from the West. And that has improved economic conditions, at least for a certain portion of the population, the influential portion of the population, if not as generally prosperous as they lead us to believe.
I agree. Now we have a super chat from Dale Scoggins for $10. Thanks, Dale. I think this is an interesting question, and I'd be interested in your response. Is TikTok a threat to USA? 24/7 Chinese-owned TikTok is hoovering up seemingly infinite bits of information about its users, their tastes, hobbies, political views, sexual preferences, their face. We do know that, you know, facial identity has gone a long ways towards the way they pair off the society there and take care of dissidents. It's the way they identify people who are against the state. What do you think of this TikTok thing? I've heard of it. I don't go on it, in part because I've heard, I don't know if it's just paranoia, but any business in China has to go through its military industrial complex. So you have to assume that data is going to be used for purposes that are fairly nefarious.
Right. My picture's not on TikTok. My address isn't on TikTok. I don't tell them what I do on TikTok. That's my own. I don't want to sanction China. I don't want to sanction a dictatorship. That's my own position. But it would seem to me TikTok would be a victim of this economic shutdown. If we withdrew, if we shut off diplomatic relations, most companies wouldn't do business. More than that, Chinese investment in the United States would dry up. And if we went so far as to impose economic sanctions or a boycott on them, which a threat to Taiwan would certainly justify us in doing, that would end TikTok's involvement in the United States. And I would certainly be heading down that path even as we speak.
So, you know, this has always been a curious thing to me. I think Rand answered it very well. I want to get your perspective on this. Why the trepidation? Why the soft responses to these to aggressive evil like the Soviet Union and China? We know, you and I have just discussed how weak they actually are, how much of a facade it is, how lacking in substance and competency these countries actually are. So why this, you know, why ginning up another monster for us to fear for the next 15 years, 20 years?
You know, there's a superficial answer that's generally given to that. Oh, we want peace. And surely war is worse than existing alternatives in a nuclear world. I think that's a very superficial answer. I think it goes much, much, much deeper to America's inability to morally identify the evil of dictatorship and to understand the evil of dictatorship. And that would, of course, require an understanding of individual rights and the moral imperative of individual liberty. So the answer here is philosophy. America, so many American intellectuals say, well, you know, communism was good in theory, it just didn't work out in practice. You know, like ex-communists would say that. So long as that idea is back there, you know, communism's good in theory, they don't have a more clear moral opposition to dictatorship. They don't have a clear moral opposition to communism or socialism or any of the other varieties of centralized state control. And until we have a clear moral answer to that, the West isn't going to have a clear moral answer. We're going to do it by what? Pragmatism. Well, we got to face each situation case by case. Sure, if Russia invades Ukraine, well, then we'll help Ukraine, the Ukrainians. But, you know, it's a case by case, go by the seat of our pants thing. We can't be wedded to rigid moral and political principles here. We have to be operating for peace. And then some of these people are suckered in by the idea that some economic liberalization and trade will somehow turn China into a Jeffersonian democracy, which, of course, it never did. But I think all of those are lesser ideas that are really take a backseat to the main driver of this. America does not have the moral clarity when it comes to fighting dictatorship, particularly communist dictatorship. We never have.
So nobody has faith in Japanese imperialism. No, you don't hear any intellectuals claiming that it looked great on paper. It just doesn't work in reality. Nobody has that same kind of sense for fascism. Oh, it's great on paper, but it just doesn't work in reality. Do you think it's because we never had that final confrontation where we could repudiate communism in the same decisive way that we did fascism and nationalist Japanese chauvinism? And do you think that really, when it comes right down to it, the only way to completely repudiate this system for once and for all is to beat the hell out of it in a war?
No, I don't think beating the hell out of it in a war is necessary any more than it was with the Soviet Empire. And the Soviet Empire's, they were always a basket case economically. Back, you know, in the 30s and 40s, they kept saying, oh, we're going to eclipse you economically and technologically and so forth. By the 60s and 70s, in the 70s, I was still having arguments with, you know, card-carrying communists who were still thinking that there was great things going on economically in Russia. They were that self-deluded. But when it finally did all come down in the late 80s and early 90s, it became quite obvious. They were barely surviving basket cases dependent on technology with the West all along. Their five-year plans were a continuous failure. By the 1970s and 80s, it was quite plain that communism could not deliver the goods. It's just that our intellectuals never got that lesson. They had plenty of facts.
But they got the lesson with fascism. Many of them were on the side of Hitler early on and thought that his reforms and Mussolini's reforms reflected a third way, a new way of doing things. So why?
Running on time. In fact, that wasn't the practical arguments against fascism that motivated people at the time. There were people at the time who were conceding, at least Benito Mussolini had the trains running on time. You know, he did build that train system in Italy, just as the Nazis built the Autobahn in Germany. Oh, it's not that they couldn't practically deliver, and they really couldn't practically deliver any more than the communists could. But they could do these infrastructure projects like socialist states can do. And they too were dependent on trade with the West, by the way, for whatever progress they did make. But it wasn't a perception of the economic failure of fascism or Nazism. It was the immorality of it. It was the evil of it. And that's what I'm going to go back to. The people may have perceived, oh, yeah, Russia didn't work in practice, but communism is still good in theory. That's where the issue is. We got to win on that theory argument about the evil of communism. So long as there's in anybody's mind, well, you know, the communists' hearts were in the right place, we're never going to win the battle.
Copy that. I agree. Mary Aline with another $5. Thank you, Mary Aline. You're always a great supporter. Says, I highly recommend the ARI New Ideal interview with Scott McDonald on what Xi really wants. That's good. I haven't heard that or seen that.
Oh, yet. I did hear most of that, and it is really good. I agree with Mary Aline. Go check that. I hadn't thought of that. Go check that out.
Thank you, Mary Aline. Is there anything quickly, a sort of a thumbnail sketch in that interview that could entice us to see it or that is relevant to the things that we're saying right now?
Way more detail here and way more background and much better philosophical context than even I'm giving it here. So I highly recommend going there. You'll get at least as much out of that as you will from this. Yeah. Thank you,
okay, Mary. Okay, so thank you, Mary Lane. ARI, New Ideal interview with Scott McDonald on what Xi really wants. Look, I think objectivists have a unique perspective on the dynamics of the world situation. I think it's a revolutionary perspective. It's the one that will keep us safe, happy, and secure. So I recommend anybody who hasn't perused the stuff at ARI to do that, and especially that particular topic. Ali Beard with $5. Thank you, Ali. More than just TikTok, they're also involved in video game corpos, sports too. I wonder if people realize just how in bed they are with everything. It definitely seems like Hollywood and sports figures are reluctant to criticize the Chinese because, hey, it's a billion people. It represents a market that they don't want to lose themselves. Now, how do you deal with that?
That's it. That's exactly it. The big markets for Hollywood and the big market for the NBA now is China. So they're taking their orders, in effect, from China. Maybe that overstates a little bit, but they sure don't want to displease China. That is really, really a bad part of our economic interdependence with China right now. Our corporations are sort of leading the march, and some of our famous athletes are apologizing for a brutal dictatorship that's engaged in, you know, the August harvesting from Uyghurs. And you'll hear famous American athletes mouth these moral justifications for them or compare America to a country like that. It's disgusting. You're absolutely right.
Well, that almost gives ammunition for the cliche writers in Hollywood who are always putting pretty much every terrible thing that happens at the feet of greed and the profit motive. You can't seem to step away from it when it comes to these folks. I clearly greed and the profit motive are not bad in and of themselves. It's what's animating that drive towards a profit. It's what's animating that desire for more and how you direct it. If it's not philosophically and ethically directed, you're going to be going in some pretty horrible directions.
What say you to that? I would ask these companies to think about their long-term interests, not their short-term interests.
That's always what yes.
asks and, us and to it, do.
Yeah, yes, and a little bit of self-promotion here. You should see my reality check on selfishness, where I talk about, you know, what selfishness really is definitely a long-term game. That's the way human beings have to look at life. Mary Aline with another $2. Thank you, Mary Aline. You're kicking ass today. The West needs moral clarity and to speak out. Yes. Now, is there anybody in office at the moment who has this moral clarity and can speak out?
No. I hate to give a single word sad answer, but no. There isn't.
I don't see
any real hope on either the left or the right from any of the major potential candidates for president, say. So, no.
Anybody in Congress?
You know, a great historian, a great objectivist historian once told me, you know, Jim, the three most important words in history are compared to what? And unfortunately, that's what American politics has reduced us to. Sometimes the choice is so disgusting, I can't even hold my nose and vote for one. I just can't vote for that office. But if there were a Republican candidate, say, who was better on this, or a Democrat candidate who was better on this, I'd pay attention to them. But right now, I don't see it on either side, unfortunately. Even the most hawkish Republicans are terrible because they're neocons who think America should sacrifice, you know, their interests for whatever, you know, hellhole out there exists in the world. Yeah. They're militant hawks. And so when anyone who might have moral clarity, I probably have huge disagreements with on that front as well. And then you've got the Trump side, who's sort of recreating the old right isolationist America first ideas. I don't trust them any more than I trust those guys. Although, frankly, I think we should try and avoid war and stay out of international affairs. Still, nonetheless, these people are Trumpist nationalists. And, you know, Trump was leading the charge and, oh, he could make a deal. He wanted to cut a deal with Xi. He could, you know, we saw how successful that was when he completely bent over for Hong Kong and betrayed them. So, no, you don't try and cut a deal with them. And the Trump try and cut a deal with them, too. So even on the Republican side, where you might think they might be a little, you know, more morally principled on this, there's really no hope in my view.
So I was hoping we could leave this, end this on a positive note. I'm not sure we can, but I want to ask you, given this complete philosophical and moral chaos that dominates Washington today, right, and the pundits and the people who comment on it, what do you think we are going to see in the next few years? What do you think will happen within the two remaining years of the Biden presidency? Because I think this is the window through which both Putin and Xi are thinking they can make whatever significant moves they can make.
Oh, yeah. Biden's perceived as weak. And, I'm not even sure the Ukraine invasion would have happened, but for the combination of Trump's and then Biden's weakness, especially in Afghanistan and so forth, and with that German pipeline and, you know, his comments like only a little invasion might, you know, Biden almost invited it by driving oil prices up and giving Russia all those profits. So, yeah, this is your time to make a move, dictatorships of the world. And they're acting like it. And since the Senate, it will probably be, you know, stalemated with another, you know, divide 49-51 or 50-50, and the House, the Republicans have a teeny little majority. I expect Congress to do basically nothing over the next 2 years, very, very little, let's put it that way. And I don't expect Biden to get any better. So I would expect that it's really what happens on the ground in Ukraine that'll probably be driving the attitudes of these dictators more than anything in Washington, because I think they're just convinced that they can get away with just about anything with Biden.
Any projections?
No, I think that the Ukraine war is going badly enough. I think they probably lost it months ago, but they're continuing to lose it in Ukraine. And I think a humiliating defeat for Russia in Ukraine is our best bet. Should that happen, I think that would probably calm down the aggressive forces of the dictators in this world, at least to some degree. And what happens in the next presidential, I mean, Trump just announced his bid for office again. So, I mean, you could just imagine.
My God.
You know, I just have one last comment, and I have to get it in. Last night he said, this isn't going to be my campaign. This is going to be our campaign. Our campaign. Because, you know, it isn't about my ego, but I'm going to go on personally nasty, insulting every other Republican candidate, just like I did last time, because it's all about me, and I'm the only one who could save America, about the cult of his personality. But it's going to be our campaign, you see. No, that narcissist, pragmatist madman has so destroyed the Republican brand, you'd think he would have the awareness to do a benefit to his own party and the two-party system in America and just get the hell out of politics.
No, you're right. I feel exactly the same way. It's maddening. And I think it's going to cause quite a bit of chaos and turmoil in 2024. And You know, like the malignant narcissist he is, he's getting off on that. It's not like he fears it. It's not like he wants to avoid it. It's not like he wants to leave society in peace. I think he wants to burn things down before he goes out, because he won't win in 2024. He won't, but he'll sure make everybody confused about the entire process, confused enough so that there will be zero faith in the process and lots of resentment and more tribalism. I see nothing good going forward with his nomination, unless somebody a little bit more powerful in the eyes of the GOP can rise up and beat him in the primary. If that happens, I think he pulls a Bull Moose. I think he does a Theodore Roosevelt. I think he goes third party out of resentment.
My great fear is that he does a Teddy Roosevelt and ruins it for a better Republican, assuming there's a better Republican out there. But I'll tell you, insofar as the Republican Party decisively would step away from Trumpism, that would at least put the Republican Party back on the possibility map for me.
Well, you know, they claim that 60% of the GOP does not support him anymore. And I agree. I mean, even the New York Post is taking pot shots at him. They're done. People are exhausted. That, you know, it was a novelty, I guess, in the first couple of years that you had this guy, as sloppy and as boorish as he was, who was fighting back against the left, who are bullies and who are condescending, and people get sick of that. But now they're sick of him. And I hope that sets with the Republicans.
Yes, I do too. Very much so. Very, very much so. And but Trump can only be a fly in the ointment for any progress. The association of him with capitalism is maybe the worst thing he's done. And his continued running on the idea that I'm a businessman, a practical problem solver, saying that The Fountainhead is his favorite novel. All he can do is damage the idea of capitalism and give capitalism the blame for whatever he was doing. You know, he got very, very lucky, actually, in terms of his own reputation in getting booted, because, you know, we'd still have inflation. Maybe not the same extent of gas price inflation, but we'd still have the same inflation. Yeah. He was outspending Obama before COVID.
Trillions.
Yeah, and he started all that COVID spending and lockdown stuff, which directly led to our out-of-control inflation right now. Yeah. So, he lucked out on that, and he should have gotten the blame for the inflation, which Republicans are letting him off the hook on now. You know, so he dodged that bullet. But should he ever get in power again, I can only think he will just completely discredit capitalism for another generation.
Yeah, it's a frightening prospect. I'm not looking to 2024. Well, James, this has been a very enlightening conversation for me. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's great. Thanks for coming on. You've been watching the Daily Objective, brought to you by the Ayn Rand Center UK, and we will see you tomorrow. Yes, I guess we have the collective tomorrow. Tomorrow is Thursday. I don't know what's going on in the collective. Maybe it's going to be a book sharing day. I hope it is. But if it isn't, it'll be interesting. And I'll see you there. Peace.
Take care.